Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to At The Movies with me, Umar Pagan and PK Pagan. So this week marks the 30th anniversary of the release of Top Gun, 30 years in, we still feel the need for speed. But when the movie was released on May 16th, 1986, most of the reviews were not glowing. In fact, if audiences had followed the guidance provided by most critics, who tended to praise the aerial sequences but deemed the story as being just a little too pedestrian, Top Gun would not have become what it did, which was the biggest hit of 1986 and the fighter jet that Tom Cruise rode into the Hollywood stratosphere. It is a film with so much staying power that it's almost a rite of passage for any film buff. That being said, we do, all of us, have these strange, sometimes unforgivable gaps in our movie watching. I, for example, have never seen Ben-Hur. I don't know why, I just have never gotten around to it. Now, Bahir Yusuf, who's here with me right now, had one of those unforgivable gaps. He had never seen Top Gun, never, never, ever, at least not until 2 days ago when he watched it in conjunction with the movie's 30th anniversary. Bahir, welcome back to At The Movies.
Thanks.
How did it feel to pop your cherry?
It was fine. It was fine. It was fine.
Said it was fine 3 times. Was that all it was to you?
It really was all that. It was just fine. People have asked me since, because I made quite a public announcement I was going to watch it and everything, and a lot of my friends sort of jumped up at me and go like, okay, you're going to call me afterwards and tell me what you think, right? My response to it has been pretty much the standard, it wasn't terrible. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, this is why I wanted to talk to you today about this, because for the most part, it seems like a movie that's held up over 3 decades. And I wanted to watch it with someone who's watching it fresh for the first time now, as opposed to someone who's revisiting Top Gun, 5 years later or 10 years later, because that's already steeped in a sense of nostalgia. About
the romance
Tom Cruise,
is already built in.
About Tony Scott, exactly. So yeah, I mean, for those who don't know, Top Gun, it's about fighter school, and Tom Cruise plays Maverick, and he is this hot jock fighter pilot, and he goes against Russians during Cold War times, and that pretty much sums it up, what the movie's about. But it's directed by the late, great Tony Scott, who's brother to Ridley Scott, of course, and it stars, Cruise, Kelly McGillis, Val Kilmer, Anthony Edwards, Tom Skerritt, a very young Meg Ryan.
Michael Ironside.
Yeah, it's got a fantastic, absolutely fantastic lineup of people. And yet, there is something about this film. There's something about this film that seems to translate across not just generations, but across geographies, because it is a very American movie.
It's dripping with Americana. It's just dripping with Americana, right? It now seems obvious with the aviators and all that, but I remember when I was in uni in the UK, one of the case studies that was brought up was the fact that essentially that movie saved Ray-Ban. Tom Cruise in Risky Business was wearing Wayfarers, and after the movie came out, everybody wanted a pair. And then Tom Cruise went and did this movie, and it came out, everybody wanted a pair of aviators. So Tom
and that
Cruise,
didn't stop in 1986.
No, that didn't stop in 1986.
Every
exactly.
time someone watched Top Gun, they went out
and bought aviators, right? So essentially, Tom Cruise saved Ray-Ban. The movie has got that sort of level of
influence.
Yeah, it's almost like, I hate to say it, but it's almost as if it's in our blood. Like, people who haven't seen it, like, I didn't see it until 2 days ago, and I still knew the aviators from Top Gun, or anybody wearing aviators was like, oh, you're trying to be like Maverick, you're trying to be like the guy from Top Gun.
And I guess that's the cultural footprint that Top Gun has left behind. Yes. I watched it again before coming here and talking to you, and it was the same. I forgot how many great lines there were in this movie that we use on a daily basis,
yeah, exactly.
but forget that we're quoting Top Gun. I feel the need for speed yeah. is one of them.
I mean, when that scene came up, like, I knew it was from the movie. I've seen the clips before. I'm on the internet and all that. So the first thing that came to mind was this the reason that Game was called that? Is this the reason why the need for speed has now felt like a car thing for the longest time, because we all knew it from the games, or rather I knew it from the games. But did the games get it from Top Gun? You know, and now that just sort of like blew my mind, you know? And I thought that was quite interesting that Slider did a thing about Crash and Burn, where he was holding a plane in his hand, and he did the crashing and burning thing. And I was just like, wow, I use these, but... I've never seen the film.
And
so
that's
pretty cool.
The references are so pervasive. And of course, they've been cited in other movies, in other TV series, in sitcoms. Your ego's writing checks your body can't cash.
Yeah, I was like, wow, that's interesting.
It's a great line.
And also, like, the other thing I wasn't prepared for was how much it looked like Michael Bay was behind the camera.
He wasn't.
He wasn't. Let's be honest. He wasn't. Let's be perfectly clear. He wasn't. But there were a lot of those shots that were very reminiscent of early Michael Bay, of The Rock from Bad Boys, you know, the sun rising over the horizon, the sort of slightly off focus back of the Tomcats as you see the plumes of turbos going off, you know, those shots were just, to me at least, felt very Michael Bay, which I thought was quite odd.
Let's go back to why you felt the movie was just fine, though. I mean, I'll tell you how I feel about the movie in a little bit. But, you know, today's all about you, Bahir.
Oh, great. Thanks,
you know,
man. Thanks.
It's your first time you've popped your cherry. And we have to know.
Hi,
I mean,
Mom.
You've cited lots of things that you've enjoyed about the film. But why was it just meh? Was it because we, and I say we meaning all your friends, have hyped it up to such a level that it just didn't live up to it?
I wouldn't say it didn't live up to it. What I will say is that the movie didn't feel like a strong movie. It just felt a lot of the bits were very gratuitous, namely the volleyball sequence.
Oh, let's talk about the volleyball sequence.
I mean, come on, really? You know,
you would be hard pressed to find a sequence like that in film in 2016.
Oh no, absolutely. I think it was a great sequence in a sort of cheesy sort of way, but it should be in a different movie. It felt weird in this film, I think, because the scene prior to that was in a classroom. Kelly McGillis's character sort of finally gives in to Tom Cruise and gives him a date, right? Suddenly you're at the volleyball scene.
Suddenly it's like, let's go to the beach.
Yeah, you know, and I kind of have to bring this up, but Tom Cruise was wearing jeans, long jeans, pretty tight, throughout the volleyball. Wait, I mean, I don't play volleyball. I'm not a sporting guy, if you've seen me, but he's wearing jeans. Even I know jeans. Tight jeans are not sort of volleyball appropriate wear. Everybody's wearing shorts. Iceman's Navigator Slider's wearing sort of like, you know, long gym pants. And it was fine, right? He's wearing jeans. I'm just like, that's weird.
You know what's weirder? The fact that he could actually spike the ball.
Oh, no, absolutely. That was one of the things that I sort of posted up on Twitter. It was like, did they lower the net for him? You know, did they sort of make it less regulation? I don't know.
But it's funny you say that because, you know, the height issue. I mean, one of the interesting things about, or interesting pieces of trivia about the film, the height issue was actually not a problem for Tom Cruise or Tony Scott. It was a problem for Paramount.
Really?
It was a problem for the studio because basically they felt it would be an issue that the height between Kelly McGillis and Tom Cruise was different. Mm. So essentially, Kelly McGillis shot almost all of her scenes not wearing shoes.
Oh.
And Tom Cruise had these boots that gave him a little bit of a boost.
Now that you've brought it up, one of the sort of shots that stood out to me was the Anthony Edwards and Tom Cruise on the volleyball sequence, right? You can tell there's a massive height gap. And it's one of those things where I thought to myself, that would never happen now. They would never let Tom Cruise, the star of the film, and ostensibly Tom Cruise, the star of the world, to be shorter than his co-actor. But in that, in 86, it was fine. You know, yeah, it's Tom Cruise. He is, you know, less taller than Anthony Edwards. And that was fine. That shot for them wasn't a problem. Whereas nowadays, I suspect, and the fact that I even noticed it sort of makes me think that that is probably a strange way that we've developed over the years.
The other interesting thing about a lot of the reviews, early reviews I was reading about Top Gun, was that, and I don't know if this is a function of where we've come as a society, but the homoeroticism of the volleyball scene is hardly ever mentioned in those early reviews.
Nobody noticed it?
No, they mentioned it as being gratuitous.
Right, okay.
But the homoeroticism is not mentioned.
Right, okay.
But yet, I think we've become a lot more aware of these things these days. So when you read a modern review or a modern take on Top Gun, not a single one goes by without people pointing out that fact.
Okay, so like for me though, right? For example, I hadn't seen it. I was watching it with fresh eyes. I was completely in the movie. I was completely not expecting the volleyball scene to come up when it did. It just came out of the blue, completely gratuitous, I accept. But as many times as I've made the homoerotic jokes based on the volleyball sequence, I didn't really feel it was that bad. I felt it was completely gratuitous, but I didn't feel like it was anything oddly homoerotic.
But what's more, you say gratuitous. It's interesting that the scene doesn't actually pull me out of the film.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't feel like it's in any way out of place
no,
in that movie.
In that movie, yeah, I completely agree.
And that's what makes it quite interesting. All of the scenes, from the strange, random, really badly lit and shot sex scenes to...
I don't know, blue curtains, man.
Blue curtains.
Blue curtains,
no, but
bro.
You know what that was, right? The fact is, on the test screenings, there were no sex scenes.
Right.
And so they had to reshoot these extra scenes because one of the criticisms from the test audiences was, you know, where's the steamy stuff?
Right.
And so they reshot this. But of course, when they were reshooting this, a lot of time had passed. Kelly McGillis had apparently lost like 21 kilos. So
right.
She was a lot thinner. Her hair was different. That's why Tom Cruise's hair is longer in that scene. So these two scenes have both of your main actors looking completely different.
The elevator sequence between the two of them was shot 6 months later.
Correct. It was same. It was the elevator scene and the bedroom scene.
Yeah. So Tom Cruise had longer hair, so that's why they had to make it wet so they could pat it down a little bit. That's why they got Kelly McGillis in an odd black baseball cap, just because,
right.
You know, they just threw on a baseball cap because her hair color was different and it was significantly shorter. So it was like, yeah, we'll just put a baseball cap on her, you know, like grab a cap from a grip or something, right? And watching it, now knowing that, I'm thinking, yeah, it was odd, but didn't feel out of place.
So I'm a big fan of this film.
Okay.
And like a really big fan of this film, but only because I am a fan of those days of the Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer style movies. So the Top Guns, the Days of Thunder, Bad Boys, Bad Boys 2, The Rock, all of that stuff. You know, that's where Michael Bay cut his teeth, right? And those guys, Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer, used to make these sorts of, I wouldn't say mindless, but really entertaining movies. I want to say which they didn't feel like they had an agenda.
Okay.
Even though you could say Top Gun was a bit glorifying of the army and of war.
Yep.
Which is actually another piece of trivia for you, which is why Bryan Adams didn't want to do the soundtrack.
Really?
So Bryan Adams pulled out from doing the theme song for Top Gun because he felt it glorified war.
Was he going to do the Kenny Loggins song?
Yes, my friend, he was. They were going to use one of his songs called Only the Strong Survive, and he didn't want to give that to them. And then I believe Toto and Bryan Adams were both asked to record Danger Zone.
Oh, my.
And they both refused, and then Kenny Loggins did it. And hold on, this is like the biggest, most recognizable song for Kenny Loggins and also for any kind of movie buff. As soon as you hear those opening chords, you know exactly what's coming,
that
right?
Riff,
Yeah, but so all of their movies didn't feel like they had that much of an agenda. Yeah, sure, they were all rah-rah America, but at the same time, they just felt so harmless.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. Yeah.
And that's what I think I enjoy about these films, and it's something we don't get these days. I mean, even if you look at Michael Bay's 13 Hours, which was the Benghazi movie. You're watching that, and it's difficult to see that without
without feeling like you're being brainwashed.
Yeah.
Without feeling like almost every other frame is an American flag, you know? And I completely agree with you, and that's true. The other thing as well I wanted to follow up on was that how you had said earlier that at the time the critics thought the story was a little pedestrian. But put this up against any modern age film where you feel the storyline's pedestrian, you would still go Top Gun is a way better film, you know? I'm looking at, say, Top Gun and, you know, I don't know, Transformers, the latest Transformers, which had, I don't know, 12 pages of script or something.
It must have,
you know? And Top Gun, as wishy-washy, as weak as the story may have been, is still a much better film than that multi-million dollar production.
Well, it had emotional resonance.
Yes.
So even if, yeah, the script between the characters felt stilted, every time you had two people talking to each other,
yeah,
it felt weak.
Yes.
It somehow managed to create a sense of emotional resonance. And I don't know what it is. Is it just because of the sheer star power of Tom Cruise that we feel that way? Or was there something deeper? Or are we just superficial?
I think in some ways, I mean, for me, this is just sort of pulling back my film nerdness, is the fact that they don't fear holding the shot. You know, they hold it there longer for the reaction, for the facial expressions. It's not three frames of action.
That's something interesting you point out, because hardly any action movie in 2016 holds the shot. Everything is so hyperkinetic, so frenetic.
Yes. And I think, sure, if you're watching it as a sequence, if you're watching a little bit of Transformers and you're watching sort of like an action sequence, it looks cool. But when you're watching a film, you want to see the punch and the reaction, right? And it goes the same with dialogue sequences. You want to see an actor deliver a line and the director making a decision to hold it on that person's face to see his expressions, or to then cut to the person who's listening to then hear to see their reactions, right? That's what this movie does a lot of. And I think the 80s, the early 90s, those movies tend to do that quite easily. Whereas nowadays, it's just a wide shot of Mark Wahlberg going, "Where's my daughter? You know, what's the big deal?" You know? Sorry. I don't think he said those lines in the film, but...
No, he didn't. That was taken.
Okay.
Let's talk about the aerial dogfights.
Oh, my God. Those dogfights were amazing.
Right?
I mean, the other point I was asking online was the fact that if they went through with Top Gun 2, which they're saying they might do and all that, right?
It's a go, man.
It's a go?
It's a go. There was a picture.
All right.
Photo with Jerry Bruckheimer and Tom Cruise. They tweeted it out.
Oh, wow.
And they said, script meeting for like Top Gun 2.
So it was 2 hours. They're done. Script meeting's done. 2 hours. Page to page, right? Cover to cover. We're good to go. Let's do this.
In real time.
Real time, man. So now I will then change my question. When they do Top Gun 2, will they have the guts to do live dogfights, or will they just CG the whole thing?
I really hope they don't CG it.
I think it'll be a cop-out if they just CG the thing, right? The amazing dogfight sequences in that film. There were quite a few realizations I made while watching this film. One of them was the fact that the majority of the film, there were no actual fighting. Even in the story, it was all training sequences. But it was shot like, you know, end of the world dogfight stuff. Spoiler alert, there were only two actual engagements with enemies at the beginning and right at the end. Everything in the middle is all just training. And I did not realize that about the film, and I thought that was amazing. The fact that even though it was a training sequence, they kept the adrenaline up as if it was a real life and death dogfight.
Also, I don't think you have to give a spoiler alert for it.
Yeah, that was the other
movie.
Thing I was going to say. Yeah. I believe 30 years is past the statute of limitations of spoilers.
Just about.
I think it's 29 and a half years.
But with the dogfights, you know, the Pentagon was highly involved in the making of this movie, and apparently they charged them $1.8 million for use of all of their planes and aircraft carriers.
It was just for the fuel, apparently.
Yeah.
They paid just for fuel.
Just for fuel, for the planes and aircraft carriers. What's more, they actually had final script approval.
Really?
So that was the cost of giving it to them for so cheap. And I think the one major thing that they wanted script approval on was on the death of Goose.
Oh.
Because they didn't want it to be a crash. They wanted it to be an ejection mishap. Because the general perception was that American pilots were crashing too much, and they wanted to avoid that perception on a big screen adaptation.
Okay, I did find it a little odd that they kept bringing up this whole thing about how $30 million taxpayers' money thing. You know, they kept bringing. I think it came up 3-4 times in the film.
Yeah, there was a quote. You know, it's not your jet. It belongs to the people.
Yeah, it belongs to the taxpayers. You know, that's a rather reckless way of treating a $30 million taxpayer money thing or something like that. Yeah. Oh, that was quite interesting.
Yeah, every hour of flight apparently costs $10,000.
Wow.
So I don't know if a present day movie, I don't know if they're going to be willing to shell out that kind of money if they can make it for 1/10 of the price using CG.
Yeah. The other thing that was quite interesting, again, I saw this morning, was the fact that the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force or whatever, allowed them to shoot one missile. There was only one missile that they were allowed to shoot. They shot that one missile once, multiple camera angles, and there was that one shot where they had to use the shot of the missile sort of coming out of the Tomcat. They just reversed it to use it again.
Very nice.
Yeah. So I thought
creative
that was quite funny.
Filmmaking.
Creative filmmaking. That's some indie filmmaking right there, bro.
I miss those kind of movies. Watching it again just this week, I realize how this is so niche. It is a movie about flight training school. It's not even a film about America versus the Russians during the Cold War. No. It's a buddy training montage film. That's what this is.
And that was my first sort of realization that I've essentially got the wrong impression about the film. It was early on in the film, I can't remember the name of the pilot that sort of resigned his post at the end of the first sort of dogfight sequence. And then the naval commander turns to Tom Cruise and goes, "Well, you were number two, but now you're number one. So I'm going to send you to Top Gun, the top training school." At that point, I was like, whoa, wait, he wasn't demoted. I had always thought that because he was such a rapscallion pilot, he was demoted to go back to training school. He wasn't. It was because he was the best. And that was like, oh, okay, cool. I'm gonna hold my judgment now. This is okay, I got this wrong.
And that's what I'm most fearful. That's what I'm most fearful about Top Gun 2, in that with everything that's happening in the world right now, I'm really hoping it's not going to be one of those message movies.
Right.
I don't need another message movie. I want the spirit of that original. I want Maverick to be an instructor.
Right. Yeah. I was just talking about it to a friend of mine earlier.
And the legend of Maverick.
Yeah, that's the great pitch, right, for Top Gun 2. He's at the end of the movie, he resigns from the Air Force to become a Top Gun instructor. It's Part 2 is written for you. It's right there. He takes over Viper's position, right? It's awesome. Michael Ironside's still great. You know, he can be the sort of the retired former instructor who he meets at the bar, you know. Like, Michael Ironside is Yoda to Tom Cruise as Luke Skywalker. It'd be great, right?
Val Kilmer needs to lose some weight.
Well, we'll see what his storyline is like. He could be, you know, he could have been, I don't know.
Iceman the Washout.
Yeah, washed out of the Navy. And he's just like this completely overweight guy. But then Tom Cruise needs another guy to help him teach these young kids how to do it.
And who else? Other than Iceman?
Other than Iceman.
Jerry Bruckheimer, we're writing a movie right here, right now.
Man.
You can get in touch with us on... Now, the movie was a huge hit. It took in $177 million in 1986. And that's just in the U.S. It took in $353 million worldwide. Massive, massive hit. And yeah, like I said earlier, this was the movie that kind of propelled Tom Cruise into just that stratospheric success. And yeah, it's a success that's lasted the better part of 3 decades.
Yeah.
He's still an incredibly bankable Hollywood A-lister.
Which is quite
unheard of.
Yeah, for an actor to have essentially an A-list status for 30 years, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know what else was top of the list, my friend, in 1986?
Oh, come on, let's go.
All right, so number two, second biggest film of the year. That ain't a knife. Crocodile Dundee.
Oh, God.
That's right. And the third biggest film of the year was Platoon.
Oh.
So there you go. One of the greatest war movies of all time. Just number three.
Number three. I mean, I mean, come on, it's Crocodile Dundee. I mean, what is a movie about war and the perils and all the heartache and pain of war when you put him up against an Aussie?
That's right.
You can't do it, mate.
This is a knife. Go watch Top Gun again. Let us know if you think the movie holds up after 30 years. You can tweet me on @UmarPagan or on @TheMoviesMY. Bahe, people can tweet you on.
Tweet me @BaheY.
That's right. And you know what? You listen to the people, Bahe.
I listened. I heard the call and I stepped up to the plate.
That's right. You listened to the voice of the Malaysian people who on our Twitter poll said, hell yeah, you should watch Top Gun. Also, if you're planning on catching X-Men Apocalypse, be sure to check out Ian McNally's and my review of the flick from last week. You can find it along with all of our other podcasts on bfm.my/movies. You've been listening to At The Movies. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold-cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.